Greetings and welcome to today's program, a meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California. I am Bill Grant, chair of the club's Health and Medicine Member-Led Forum and the chair of this program. Our speaker today is Dr. Alfredo Quiñones Hinojosa. He received a medical degree from Harvard University, where he graduated cum laude. He went on to complete his residency in neurosurgery at the University of California, San Francisco, where he also completed a postdoctoral fellowship in developmental and stem cell biology. At Johns Hopkins University in Baltimore, Maryland, Dr. Quiñones is an associate professor of neurosurgery and oncology, neuroscience, and cellular and molecular biomedicine. In addition to directing the brain tumor surgery program at Johns Hopkins Bayview Hospital and the pituitary surgery program at the Johns Hopkins Hospital, Dr. Quiñones leads the brain tumor stem cell laboratory. He focuses on the surgical treatment of primary and metastatic brain tumors with an emphasis on motor and speech mapping during surgery, as well as in the treatment of patients with pituitary and skull-based tumors using transsphenoidal, endonasal, and minimally invasive surgical approaches. Today, he is known as Dr. Q, an internationally renowned neurosurgeon and neuroscientist who leads cutting-edge research to cure brain cancer. Named as one of the 100 most influential Hispanics in 2008, Dr. Q was also selected by Popular Science magazine as one of their 6th annual Brilliant 10 in their search for young genius influence in the course of science. Among his extensive publications in the medical field, Dr. Q is the lead author for the upcoming edition of Schmeidig and Sweet's Operative Neurosurgical Techniques, the world's preeminent encyclopedia of neurosurgery. Dr. Q conducts numerous research efforts on elucidating the role of stem cells in the origin of brain tumors and the potential role stem cells can play in fighting brain cancer and regaining neurological function. He has received R01 funding from the National Institute of Health for his work with stem cells and cancer, and his awards also include grants from the Howard Hughes Medical Institute, Physician Scientist Early Career Award, the Robert Wood Johnson Foundation, and the Maryland Stem Cell Foundation. Besides being a constantly in-demand lecturer on an array of subjects, Dr. Q continues to galvanize public attention. On the award-winning ABC series Hopkins, he was the lead episode. Along with his appearances on such shows as Nova, CNN, and Sanjay Gupta, CBS News and Katie Couric, NBC's The Today Show, as well as on National Public Radio, Dr. Q has been featured in a variety of newspapers and magazines and has a growing online following. Dr. Q.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Grant. After that wonderful introduction, everything is going to go downhill. I would love to just sit right there, and at one point I probably will sit right there, if it's okay with you. I'd like to make this a little bit more conversational rather than lecture type. I'm a faculty at Hopkins, and I get to give so many lectures all the time to the medical students, if it's okay with you, I'll do an introduction. I'll make you think of a few things, and then I'm going to grab the microphone and put a chair in front and just talk with you and answer some questions. Anything is valid, personal, non-personal, professional, political. I begin to realize that I am being put in situations where it's making me think outside the box. I always tell people I'm just a simple brain surgeon and a scientist, and I live in that bubble, and I really do mean it. You know, it's so easy for me to go into the operating room and do what I do. That's what I trained. You know, I trained for many years, and my brain works that way. I go in, and I'm like the special forces of brain surgery. I go in for tumors that other people don't want to take out. I take them out. I map the brain. And the patients likely wake up most of the time. And every now and then I deal with patients that no matter what we do, their outcome is absolutely devastating. What I do and what I deal the most is with cancer. And I would bet that almost everybody here has been touched, either family, friends, or knows of someone who has had some type of cancer. I personally deal with brain cancer, which right now there's about 40,000 people battling brain cancer, the malignant brain cancer. That's not the metastatic brain cancer that comes from your body into the brain. That's several hundred thousand people dealing with that. I'm just talking specifically about the cancer that took the life of Senator Kennedy, the malignant brain cancer. So about 40,000 people. Every year, 3,000 new people get affected by this cancer. And I operate in about 200 of those. So there's not a lot of people in the United States. Think about it. My percentage is pretty high. And we have great centers here at UCSF where I train, and obviously at Johns Hopkins. So it is indeed the most lethal type of cancer. So I put that as a sort of the introduction as to what I do. And I love what I do as a brain surgeon, alrighty? And I would say that I have an incredible amount of respect, and I am humble every single day to be given an opportunity and the blessing of operating on patients, and with my patients to be part of history through what I do in the laboratory. So every one of my patients, before they go into the operating room, they sign consent. That is Institutional Review Board approved by Johns Hopkins. And they agree that their tissue, instead of throwing it to the biomedical waste, it goes into my laboratory, and I spend my whole life not only writing grants, but most recently raising funds for brain cancer. And we send that tissue to the lab, and they become part of history. All right. And I have never met a patient where you tell them the tissue is either going to go to waste or we can use it to find a cure one day. Every single one. So we are becoming, and my business is to give them hope that one day we can find a cure for this. And I have dedicated a lot of time, and I got to tell you, next week, Saturday, so I am here this whole week. I've been doing meetings and meetings, talks. I go to Berkeley tomorrow, tonight in UCSF. I fly out Tuesday night to take a red eye. I go to UPenn. I give about 3 talks in Pennsylvania. Some of them are academic. Some of them are about my book. And then I get to home around midnight, and then between Thursday and Friday, I do 8 craniotomies for patients with brain tumors. This is how, and these are people from all over the world. I would say that I treat very few people from local. They come from all over the United States. And this is the same kid who came to this country in 1986, 87 as an illegal alien. And I put the word illegal right there because it's hot. It's controversial. And a lot of people believe that I shouldn't be here today, you know. And I respect their opinion. A lot of people believe that I took the spot of someone else. And I was with Mayor Bloomberg 2 weeks ago, talking to him, and this is how my life has changed. And I throw names, not because I know them. Actually, I don't know them. I just met him one day. He got a copy of my book. He called me the next day that he was really impressed. He's actually a major donor for Hopkins. He's friends with the dean, and the dean asked me to be part of this economic summit at the U.S. Chamber of Commerce. And he was saying, you know, guys, when Dr. Quiñones came to the United States, not a lot of people were lining up to work in the fields. When Dr. Quiñones moved from the fields to work in the railroad, not a lot of people were lining up to become welders. And guess right now our unemployment is through the roof. And guess what are the 2 jobs that are in most demand in the United States? Agriculture and welding. And that's, I don't know the numbers. He knew all the numbers, you know. And he said, he looks at me and he goes, well, Dr. Quiñones has job security. Brain surgeon doesn't work for him. He can go back to do those things, you know. So this is the reality of the situation. And so people have asked me, why is it that I love the brain? And I do have a passage that I like to read to you because I really couldn't put it in better words. You know, one of the things that I love about this book, and I wrote it with Mim, who's an incredible writer. She spent a lot of time with me. She came and was right on my side at Hopkins, not only when the show Hopkins was being filmed, but through many cases seeing patients. And people say, you know, people who know me, they say, the book sounds like you. And I said, I should hope so, because that was the whole idea. I wanted her to help me capture my voice. I'm a good storyteller. I'm relatively good. I can write about science, but I'm not a very good writer. So I wanted someone who would be along in the journey with me, who can help me tell the story the way I see. And a lot of people have written about me, but I wanted to write about myself and the way I see the world. So in page 262, I'm going to read a passage as to why is it that I like the brain. And it's as follows. On this point, in fact, while grabbing a quick nap in my office one afternoon just before a radio interview, I dreamed that I was already on air and commenting on my philosophy when the interviewer asked me, why do you love the brain so much? In my sleep, I knew the answer immediately. No matter how different we are from one another, black, white, yellow, Jewish, Christian, rich, poor, educated or not, our brains are all the same. The same beautiful, noble gray color, the same shape and size. I love the small and large red rivers that run through everyone's brains like roads that show us the way to unravel the universe. I love how every single person's brain can dance just as magnificently as the next person's. I can tell the difference between brains of patients of different races, religions, or classes because they have all these features in common. You know, and that's why I love the brain. And every day I am blessed that I get to touch it. You know, when I was a little kid, I wanted to be an astronaut. And I talk about my book, how I used to go to the roof of my house. We live very poor. But by the mid-1970s, the economic depression, by the early 80s, you know, we were at the lower level of the middle class, and there was an incredible exacerbation of the bifurcation of classes. United States felt it in the early 80s. The rest of the world, imagine the magnification. And in my case, we went from at least having food on our table to not having anything. I used to go to the roof of my house and look at the stars and think about being an astronaut. And I used to watch the show Star Trek. And I talk about the small little black and white TV that my brother and I purchased for about 5 pesos. And it wasn't working, and we fixed it. And we watched this show once a week and every Thursday. And the television was horrible, but our imagination was wild. And I dreamed about being an astronaut and navigating the universe. And guess what I do today? I navigate the universe, and I hold the universe of our brain in between my hands every day. I go into the operating room, and I get to see the small little cells that we call astrocytes in the human brain. And our laboratory, for the first time, believe it or not, has been able to look at human cells migrating on human brain. And that's a paper that we have submitted right now. So people said, you know, you are here because you have an accent. You're here because you're Mexican. I can assure you that the NIH did not sponsor my work because I have an accent or because I came to this country legally. You, the taxpayers, have funded my work because you believe that I have an opportunity to find a cure for cancer. And I love that part of the American dream. The American dream has gotten, obviously, more challenging for a lot of people, but I still think it lives on in our hearts. And a lot of people, over the past 2 decades, they forgot that the American dream is very simple about sacrifices, about the price of triumph, and about working 7 days a week, 24 hours a day, whatever it takes. Most people think that they can accomplish the American dream Monday through Friday, 9 to 5. That's not right, you know, to be honest with you. I have the privilege of taking care of patients who are the real heroes in our world. This last Friday, I did an interview with NBC and one of my patients, John Petrovic, and I can tell you his name, and I'm not breaking any federal laws because he's been already featured by himself on the media. About 4 years ago, he was training for the Baltimore Marathon, 23 years old, right at Georgetown Law School, bright future ahead of him. Suddenly, he drops on the floor, and he is having convulsions and seizures. He goes to one of the local hospitals, and they tell him, John, you have a brain tumor. They send him to one of the neurosurgeons, and the neurosurgeon says, you know, there's a few people who do these tumors right where you have it because it is on the part of the brain where speech and motor function is important. And that guy is Dr. Quiñones. You need to go and see him at Hopkins. So a week later, we went into the operating room. He woke up after the surgery, and the details are written here. He woke up after the surgery unable to move one side of his body. That was actually the easy part, to be honest with you, because over the next 2 weeks, he recovered. And I knew that he was going to recover because I mapped the brain. That's what I do. When I came out of the operating room, I knew the electrical function of the brain was intact. But the brain is the unexplored frontier. There are other parts of the brain that are important for people to move and to think, to talk, and do all those kind of things that we take for granted. And that was one of the parts where the tumor had invaded. He recovered, went through chemotherapy and radiation, and comes to see me and says, Dr. Quiñones, I got to tell you, the surgery was the easy part. I am absolutely spent. I mean, he dropped about 40 pounds, and John is this nice 6'3", very muscular young man, fit, you know, as you can possibly imagine. So 2 months before the Baltimore Marathon 3 years ago, he decided, you know, when he walked out of his house and he couldn't even walk a block without being completely exhausted, he said, I am going to train for the Baltimore Marathon. Not only that, I am going to make a difference on the life of other patients, and I'm going to raise funds for this race, for Dr. Quiñones Laboratory. So he did, raised about $30,000 that year, and since then he kept racing. And he kept inviting me to join him on the race, and I said, John, it's been about 2 decades since I done serious exercise. In my book, I talk about how I did 3 amateur fights already, and I used to run a lot, and I was young, and I was fit, and I said, but I think that you're going to have to take this one solo. You're going to have to go alone in this one, but I'll be at the finish line, and I'll be cheering up for you. And then this summer, first week of July, around July 4th, he's once again training for this year's marathon, which is going to be next Saturday, and he has another seizure. The tumor is back with a vengeance. It's the same tumor that took the life of Senator Kennedy. I took him back to the operating room. He's going through chemo and radiation. Same story all over again. And Friday, he and I, we did a 10-mile run before I came to my West Coast. And we are doing the race on Saturday. And I got to tell you, this leg right here, it's called the gastrocnemius muscle. I got a grade 3 tear. So it hurts a lot. So I am putting bandages. And I ran, and I went for a 6-mile run here in beautiful San Francisco just a few days ago. But the pain reminds me that is nothing compared to the pain that he is going through and the pain that his family is going through. And he's still raising funds for brain cancer. And that's what drives me. This is what motivates me. These are the real heroes. One of the secrets, obviously, or the challenges that we have is, how do you tell your story? I am sure that in this room, every single one of you has a wonderful story to tell. I have no doubt in my mind, in my heart, that that is the case. And many times, the greatest challenge is, how do you tell that story? How do you put it in words so that way your children, your grandchildren, your relatives can benefit from that? I've been blessed, obviously, that the media paid attention to what I was doing. Naomi Schneider from UC Press, you know, at Berkeley, put attention to this and decided to write, you know, a book about this. And I had a wonderful writer, obviously. But I can assure you that every single one of you has a beautiful story to tell. And that is the magic. And that's what I love, what I do as a brain surgeon, touching human brains, touching lives, going through this drama of what I do every day. But to be honest with you, my education didn't start by that. As you know, my education in the United States began in the fields as a farm laborer with these hands. Same. They weren't as soft as they are nowadays. They were full of calluses. And I used to pick the tomatoes that many of us ate at the time. And I certainly, that's how I was so fit. I used to eat tomatoes and cantaloupe and all the good stuff. And eventually moved out of there to go to UC Berkeley. But before that, I was in San Joaquin Delta College, in a community college. This is from 89 to 91. By the time I made it to 1991 to UC Berkeley, I was already a permanent resident. I benefited from the loss of Ronald Reagan at the time, in the late 80s. Alrighty, some people may not like Ronald Reagan. I personally had a great deal of respect, and I'm very thankful for the things that he did with our country around that time, and especially because I benefited. The immigration reform of California was the sign for people like me who came to this country as migrant farm workers. And it took me years to realize, when I was giving the commencement speech at Harvard in 1999, to realize that what people thought was a weakness, it was indeed one of the greatest strengths that I had. Every single job that I did, going from there to community college, working on the railroad as a welder, and I used to shovel sulfur at one point and fish lard and all these jobs, I love every single one of them. My challenge was, how can I make it better? And it's the same philosophy that I have nowadays. Every day I go into the operating room, and before I go in, I throw the stitches, I open the brain, and I think about it, I dream about it. People ask me, how many hours does it take you for preparation for brain surgery? And I said, the brain surgery for that patient begins the moment I meet that patient. So that can be months before. So by the time I walk into the operating room arena, that operation is taking place in my brain so many times. Some of you guys may have read the book Blink by Malcolm Gladwell. And it is really resonates with a lot of people because that's how my brain works. I'm constantly thinking about how I'm going to make it better. But it was the same philosophy that I had. I am the same kid, by the way, that came here, you know, over 20 years ago. Nothing has changed. Now I dress a little bit nicer and I have a nice suit and a, you know, a nice tie and things like that. But nothing has really changed, to be honest with you. I was the same kid that people told you can't. And I hear that every single day. When I went to Harvard, you can't go to Harvard. When I went to UCSF, you can't go to UCSF. When I went to the number one program in neurosurgery at Hopkins, and the number one hospital said, you can't go to Hopkins, and so on and so forth. Now people tell me, you can't find a cure for cancer. So guess what I do? Every day, I wake up at 4:30 in the morning, my alarm goes off, and then I stay in bed another 10 minutes. Those are enjoyable 10 minutes. Why? Because I'm human. I am tired, just like everybody else in the morning when I wake up. Do you think I'm not tired? People think that I have tons of energy. The reality, I'm just human. I need sleep, just like everybody else. But those 10 minutes, I enjoy because it reminds me of how blessed I am to be where I am today. And how my patients are struggling, many of them, and their families to try to find the disease. Around 1989, a decisive moment, and I'm only going to talk for another 8 minutes if it's okay with you, and then I'll open it. A decisive moment came in my life. I almost lost my life. And I talk about this. It was a dramatic, it was literally out of a movie. And somehow, my coworkers, my father, and my brother-in-law were able to save me from the jaws of death, literally. I was down in a tank, liquefied petroleum gas, 19 feet below, with no oxygen and having convulsions. They got me out of there. And I tell the story in my book, obviously. And what really happened that day, it was I was given a gift. And my father told me around that time, and I still have a plaque, when I finished medical school at Harvard, my parents, they couldn't understand, first of all, why is it that I wasn't sitting with them in the audience side? Why was I in the front, you know, getting ready with Dave Satcher and the dean of Harvard Medical School? They had no idea that I was about to give the commencement speech because I never really told them. They never went to Harvard to visit me. They come from very humble backgrounds. Very few people understand that my father went to 2 months of first grade school education and my mother went to first grade education. So they really, but they were absolutely brilliant. And I tell you why they were brilliant. Somehow, they figure out the way to channel the energy of this kid who was absolutely, absolutely crazy. That was me. So I would be all over the place. And my parents somehow were able to put that energy to good use. And I talk about some of this experience that I had as a little kid. So when I went on and I almost lost my life, it was really an event in my life that made me appreciate. And it took years for me until I started writing this book around 2007 to really deal with this, to be honest with you. Real emotional, in an emotional way, because I never talked about what it was like to almost be dead. All right? Because I didn't want to think about it. I was so focused on trying to move forward, you know, in my career. And I did move fast. I got to tell you, I went to Hopkins as an assistant professor in 2005 in October. And this July, less than six years later, my chairman forwarded all my paperwork and my nomination to full professor at Hopkins. I may have an accent, I tell people, but our brains do not think with an accent. All right? So very accelerated. As you can imagine, to move to full professor as a surgeon at a major institution is once again is based on academic productivity, publishing the Bibles of neurosurgery, doing a lot of peer review publications, getting federal grants, and doing 300 brain tumors a year, which brings a lot of money to the hospital, if you know what I mean. Not to me, obviously, because I'm an academic center, but I am blessed to do what I do. All righty. So by 2007, 2008, a lot of stories came to me with my patients. And one particular story that I like to read is in page 286, and it's an experience that I had with Sharon. And I'll tell you a little bit about Sharon right now as I read. This is a young woman that came to see me from Virginia. Her husband was just came back from the Middle East, where he was stationed in the war, and that she was having problems, and they had two little kids. All right, young couple, beautiful couple, mid-20s, and here it comes. I will never forget walking into an exam room with devastating news for my patient Sharon, a young mother in her early 20s who had traveled to Baltimore from out of state with her husband, a soldier just returned from an overseas tour of duty. When the couple arrived at the clinic, we first talked about their two children, a toddler and a baby, and the joys and challenges of parenting. Sharon was bright-eyed, thoughtful, and stoic when I described the surgery and the follow-up treatment for what I suspected was a high-grade malignant tumor. We were able to reach her primary care doctor back home, put him on the speakerphone, and coordinate a plan of action for when she returned. Everything went perfectly in the operating room from a technical standpoint, but when I removed the tumor and sent it for an intraoperative test, it looked as dangerous as I had anticipated. A senior pathologist came to the operating room to confirm that the initial flash freeze read showed that it was a high-grade malignant tumor. The final biopsy in turn revealed to be one of the fastest-growing high-grade glioblastoma multiforme, the same tumor that took the life of Senator Kennedy, but this one was in the brain stem. This is where breathing, heart rates, consciousness leaves, and we did a biopsy with a needle all the way down into that. So I didn't go into the details of the surgery, but I can assure you that when I do this, my heart rate goes to about 160. In my post-op meeting with Sharon and her husband, I first commented on her courage. And by the way, as you sit here today, you look great. What is your secret? With a nervous smile, she said, brain surgery. I then had to tell them that my worst fear had been confirmed about the nature of the tumor and described the best and worst case scenarios for life expectancy. Of course, we had treatment options and would be vigilant in applying them. Sometimes in such meetings with patients, I explain the numbers mean little and that it is not helpful to put a finite limit on time left. But Sharon and her husband insisted on knowing the general expectations so that they could actually plan. I told them that we would try to buy more time and stave off an immediate progression. Another year would be a blessing, but we would try for two more years. At that moment, they realized with sudden certainty that she was really going to die. Sharon did something that I will never for the rest of my life forget. She turned to her husband, put her hand on his knee, and as both of them gave into tears, she looked into his eyes, saying softly but powerfully, "I love you." With those three words, she said everything. That she knew he would be left with two little children to raise without their mother, that he would live the rest of his life without his soulmate and partner. She was not thinking of herself at that moment, only of her loved ones. Experiences like that I have every day, and they touch my heart, as you can imagine. The world, Albert Einstein once said, is a dangerous place. Not because of people who do evil, but because of those who see and do absolutely nothing. In my life, as I tell my students, as I tell my scientists, and I direct a laboratory with 23 of them, and they're absolutely brilliant. They all come from different parts of the world, different religions, different races, you know, all the way from the most prestigious institutions that you can imagine to the ones that are unknown. But everybody has something to contribute to my team. And I tell them that success is going from failure to failure without the loss of enthusiasm. And I didn't say that. It was actually Winston Churchill. Once, when I was here at UC San Francisco, and I saved the life of a cop, it was all over the news. This was in the early 2000s. Nick Ferrando. And I, once again, I can say his name because he was in the news here at San Francisco. We took him to the operating room about three times in one night. And this young man, you know, we literally, not just thanks to me, but to the whole trauma team, we were able to save his life. And 2 years later, he was back on the streets of San Francisco taking care of all of us. All right? And I remember from that, I got two things. Number one was a plaque. And this plaque's in my office at home. And it says the following. It was a quote from Vince Lombardi for all those football aficionados. The quality of a person's life is in direct proportion to their commitment to excellence, regardless of their chosen field of endeavor. Let me repeat that. The quality of a person's life is in direct proportion to their commitment to excellence, regardless of their chosen field of endeavor. The second thing that I got was a card. It was at the time the chief of police, Alex Fagan. And in the back, he said, any courtesies you can extend to Dr. Quiñones would be highly appreciated. This is my cell number. It was a get-out-of-jail card, as you can imagine. You know, luckily I never used it, but I did keep it, actually, as a sort of something that reminded me of how blessed I have been in my life. So, I'd like to sit with you guys right here and answer any potential questions you may have, and I'll take the microphone so that way we can continue with the recording. Thank you. Any comments, positive or negative?
I'm so delighted to meet you because I heard a couple of years ago when the Johns Hopkins program was on television that you had come in as an undocumented immigrant, and I wondered how you got legalized, and now I know. And you wanted to make an issue of it. Well, Michael Bloomberg on April 24th made a speech on Fox News in which he said he believed in legalizing all undocumented immigrants and it would be good for New York and Detroit and the rest of the country. And he was asked, isn't that the same as amnesty? And he said, yes. And he said, well, what should we do about that? Nobody believes in amnesty anymore, which Ronald Reagan did. And Michael Bloomberg answered, have them pay a fine. It didn't change him at all. But I know many, I'm on the Immigrants' Rights Commission here in San Francisco, and I know many undocumented immigrants, some of whom are now legal. And everyone except one I have asked how they got legal. It was by marriage. And it's very hard to get people to talk about legalizing undocumented immigrants. And I wanted to ask you your ideas on how we can change the situation back to something like what Ronald Reagan did in 89.
Well, this is a very heavy question. I always start with a disclaimer. Once again, I said it at the beginning, I'm not a politician. I am not an expert in economics. And I'm just a simple brain surgeon and scientist. And I live in that bubble, to be honest with you. But I have had to think about this. And like I said, 2 weeks ago, when I met Mayor Bloomberg, and then subsequently he read my book and he called me, and I was shocked that he called me in my cell. First of all, I don't know how he got my cell, obviously, but I was delighted to hear his voice. And he was very laudatory and congratulatory, obviously, about the book and how much he enjoyed it. And he's been a strong supporter of Johns Hopkins. And this is a man who is arguably one of the top 20, if not the 13th wealthiest men in the United States, if not the world, who believes very strongly in some of the issues that you just raised. And I have to think, I'm not an expert in economics, but I have to think about the price that we will pay as a society if we don't educate our children. And I know that when you look at illegals, they actually only account for less than 1% of the people that we need to educate. So we have an incredible, at least that's the numbers, and I'm not an expert on these numbers, so it may be more, but Mayor Bloomberg was saying that the problem is much deeper. You know, every time we go through a difficult time in our country, the first thing that we do is we turn around and say, who can we blame? Who is at fault for me not having a job, health insurance, or a good education in our public system? We've done it for hundreds of years. This is not new. Yet we still have the most beautiful nation in the world. It's the only nation where people risk their lives to come in and live and try to fulfill their American dream. So I don't know if the amnesty is the solution. I can only tell you that when my dean asked me to go and be at this meeting with Mayor Bloomberg, he said, you are the perfect example as to why we need smart laws so we can capitalize on people like you so we can make our country a better place to live. I don't have a solution, but I do need that these kind of forums getting people engaged, and I always welcome controversy. People say, oh my gosh, there's an article somewhere on the internet that one of my students shared with me of a mathematician who said the chances that someone like Dr. Quiñones would become a brain surgeon is 1 in 40 million. So I said, this mathematician is missing the point. I'm not advocating that everybody becomes a brain surgeon. I'm not advocating that everybody becomes a doctor or a lawyer. We need people who are well-trained in all different professions in our economy, starting with good farm labor workers and welders, all right? Because if we don't do that, our children and our grandchildren are going to be the ones that are going to be outsourcing to some of the other countries around the world. It's that simple.
Thank you. I've got a quick question. Ted Kennedy's brain cancer was near his ear, which is where he used a cell phone. So it's probably due to cell phone use, heating the brain and getting inflammation and so on. Do you have any idea what fraction of the tumors you treat are perhaps from cell phones?
Well, I got to tell you one thing. This is a great question, and one that I just commented in Men's Health magazine about 2 weeks ago. I had an interview, and I had an interview in ABC. I've been with Keith Black, who's one of the brain surgeons at Cedars-Sinai in L.A. Bottom line, there is no conclusive evidence that cell phones will give rise to brain cancer. There are some suggestive data out of Europe, and recently the World Health Organization said it is a potential carcinogen and put it in the same category as some soaps and some perfumes and some other stuff. But the fact that they said cell phones could potentially be carcinogenic, you know, that raised a lot of brows, so a lot of people are concerned. So they asked me, what is your advice? I said, well, use cell phones just like you would use any technology wisely. When I'm in my car, I either use an earpiece or I put the speaker phone to make phone calls. When I'm in my office, if I have the choice between using a landline and my cell phone, I use the landline. And I am certainly never in conversations that are more than 5 or 10 minutes on the actual phone. People have looked at the waves and all this kind of stuff, and the bottom line is that there's no conclusive evidence. But be mindful. It may be that 30 years from now, we do see a rise on brain tumors, and that's obviously of concern.
Doctor, were you involved with Ted Kennedy's surgery, or were you on his health care?
I was involved in consulting for him as part of our team at Johns Hopkins, but the two teams that took care of him surgically beautifully was the Mass General and Duke. Actually, so there was about two or three of us from Hopkins that were consulted and were part of the original team that had actually done, you know, some of the potential avenues for surgery and what else to do. Because remember, originally he had a biopsy for the diagnosis at the Mass General, and then he had to decide for a more aggressive surgical resection.
Doctor, California just passed the DREAM Act, and, you know, who knows what the rest of the country is going to do. At what point in your education were you when you became a resident?
Yes.
And how were you able to deal with?
I can tell you exactly. So when I was working in the fields in 1987, I was given, so Ronald Reagan said, if you can show me that you had worked in the field for 90 consecutive days, I will give you a working authorization. And it was a small little red card. If you pay your taxes, and I don't think there was a fine there, actually. If you pay your taxes and you become a meaningful citizen of our society, I will give you, that was part, not really the amnesty, but it was sort of something that California did around that time. Why? Because they were trying to keep us from sending money to other parts of the world, especially Mexico. So if you pay your taxes, that working authorization will become a temporary green card. Temporary. If you continue, it'll be a permanent green card. So by the time I was in community college, I had my permanent green card, By the time I came to UC Berkeley, I was already a permanent resident. And then when I went to Harvard Medical School in 1997, I was already there from 94 to 99, that's when I became a U.S. citizen. So it's different, obviously, than what we have today. I really don't have a solution for what we have today, but I was looking at the newspaper this morning in Time Magazine also that apparently there's going to be, 2,500 students that could potentially qualify for financial aid and so on and so forth. There's a lot of stuff going on, but I do know that when you look at the amount of money that that a person can earn between being a high school graduate and a college graduate is double. And that amount, that also amounts to more taxes paid. I don't know how this translates into the economy, but I got to tell you that at the end of the day, it makes us all think as to why is it that this is the most beautiful country in the world and how was this country funded and made, obviously. And I would say that most people, when I first came in, I didn't know I was going to end up today sitting in front of you. I didn't know that I was going to be, a brain surgeon at Johns Hopkins. All I wanted to do was to eat, literally, and to put food on the table of my parents. That's it. And I can assure you that most people who come to this country, that's their dream. Somehow, there is a disconnect between the first and second generation, specifically, I'm talking now specifically about Mexican-American immigrants. I don't know how to solve that. I have my own ideas. This is one of them. Write in my book and telling them, don't expect an education for free. Don't expect things to be given to you. Get up every day and work as if this is going to be your last day. And if you do that, I promise you, no matter how many people may disagree with you, no matter how many death threats you may get, which I do get, by the way, your dream will come true. Please.
Doctor, I presume you're brilliant.
I don't know about that. But I do work harder than everybody else I know.
I believe that. And it's still a hard story for me to understand how you could come to this country and be worried about enough food and somehow find access to all the education you got. I say I presume you're brilliant. I presume you probably went on scholarship most of the way. But really, it's such an incredible story. I don't understand how you got from where you were and got through the educational system that you did.
Well, that was once again, this is one of the mathematicians. The chances are small. Alrighty. And I would also say that there's a misconception. Most people think that I got an education for free. I paid a debt of $250,000 as of this year for my education. And I paid about 60% of my income on taxes for the American government, for our country. And I am happy to do so. Okay. And my kids go to public schools because I believe on the public system. The truth is, thank you. I believe very strongly about that. So people have asked me, how do you do it? How did it happen? Well, I recollect a lot of stories. Nothing is perfect. If you look at my path, it wasn't really perfect. There were a lot of detours. I met a lot of people. This morning, a very dear friend of mine by the name of Peter Dye, and he's in page 168 of my book, he just saw my article in the LA Times and says, Alfredo, I can't believe it. The interview they did is just exactly the way I met you when I knew you in San Joaquin Delta College. I never gave up. And it was always a small little things. Like when I was in community college and I wanted to learn English, I just showed up to the community college, paid money to go and learn English. And then I met Peter, and they say, you got to go to college. You got to go to university. And I had no idea. So I kept working on it. By the time I was at UC Berkeley, I met a person who I wasn't paying attention. I wasn't comparing myself to other people. And I never do that. I compare myself to myself every single time. And I ask myself every day when I wake up in the morning, how can I be better at what I do today, either in science, surgery, or as a human being? So when I was at Berkeley, I didn't compare my grades to other people. I just kept working as hard or harder than anybody else. And I'm hypomania probably, but then now you'd realize that. So by the time I was in my last year at Berkeley, someone looks at my scores and my grades, and they realized, and I said, I'm thinking that maybe I should go to medical school because I tried law, and I hang out with lawyers, and I realized that I really didn't have a lot in common with lawyers. Nothing wrong with being a lawyer, but I just didn't have anything in common. And said, but I'm thinking medical school. And this guy looked at this, and he says, whoa, with these grades and what you have done, you can go to Harvard if you want to. And I thought, this guy is cuckoo, living la vida loca. Obviously, he was a little bit crazy. I didn't know, but I never went around. And when I went, so every single day I wake up and I ask myself, what am I going to do today that is going to make a difference? I deal with science, I deal with surgery, and it's difficult to, for people to understand. And that's what I say, you know, when I advocate education, I'm not advocating that every immigrant, legal or illegal, which are many, should become a brain surgeon or an astronaut or a scientist or whatever. We need a lot of good people. We need to educate our children so they can help us live a better life in the future. But I don't have a short answer to your question, to be honest with you. I was hoping, because I get hundreds, if not thousands of emails a year from students all over the United States, medical schools, undergraduate, who want me to be their mentor. I can't. And I said, read my book. If you want to know how I did it or get a sense, everybody has a different recipe, it's right there in the book. And that's exactly why I did this. It was the beginnings of me telling other people that I'm just a regular guy who somehow has been able to turn all that negative energy that people have given me through the years into positive energy. And every single day I wake up as tired as anybody else in this room, I'm sure. Please. Oh, we have.
Yes, you've already answered some of the questions I had. But I was curious how old you were when you came to the U.S. and how you physically got here. And if your parents have lived long enough to enjoy your successes and be proud
it's
of
interesting.
You.
So I was 19 when I first came to the United States, and I literally, you know, I was hungry. I didn't know what to do. We were going through a very difficult time. And I just one day, I didn't have any family who had immigrated to the United States as an educated person. Everybody in my family who'd come to the United States for generations as either braceros, the people who came in to do the farm labor, and then when the borders were put, they couldn't come in only with permissions, and then when that got stricter, then they can only come in with the so-called coyotes, the people who smuggle people. And I didn't have $600, which is how much it costed at the time. Nowadays, it's about $6,000, all right? So I didn't have $600. All I had was $65 in my pocket, and I had a plan. And you've seen the movie with Tom Hanks where he gets stranded in the airport and has nothing to eat, I remember. So that was me actually when I landed in L.A. And how little did I know, you know, I'm going to be in L.A. next week. I land in L.A. nowadays and I am a brain surgeon. It's a completely different story, I believe. But that's how I ended up. I said, I have $65. I need to be ingenious. So I hopped the fence literally physically. I got myself into the airport in San Diego and bypassed the checkpoints. You wouldn't be able to do that nowadays. I mean, things have completely changed, obviously, but that's how I did. And my parents, they are beginning to understand what I do. You know, it's sad, but my parents know more about what I do through the media than through me, because I grew up in a culture where we don't tend not to talk a lot about what I do. You know, I try to be as humble as I can. I talk to you more than I talk to my parents about what I do. So they find out through the media, sometimes with television, shows of what I do. But they are obviously very proud of what I have done.
So did you actually run across the border?
I hopped the fence. I literally went over. You know, it was about 16, 18 feet. You know, no different than the tank where I fell and I almost lost my life. I was young and I was hungry and I really didn't think. Most people say, well, you had a choice. Maybe I did have a choice to stay behind and struggle. And I am not saying that I condone what I did, to be honest with you. All I said is that when I first came, there was no one lining up to work picking tomatoes and doing some of the work that I was doing. And there was a high demand for that, as it still exists, to be honest with you. You ready? And when I went in from there to become a welder and shovel lard, there was no one lining up for those jobs. You know, and by this time, you know, I was already fixing all my paperwork. So that's how I ended up here in the United States. Please.
Is your book being translated into other languages, for example, Spanish?
Yes, actually, as of Naomi Schneider, the question is whether or not the book is going to be translated. She is working on actually doing the translation right now. They're going through the Haas Foundation, I think that it's one of the foundations from the Berkeley area, from the Levi Strauss family. So they're working on that. I don't know if there's anything conclusive. Once again, I do the easy stuff. I always tell people, I do the brain surgery and the science. I let everybody else deal with all the paperwork that it takes to accomplish these things. Please, my dear. Thank you.
Hello, Doctor. Do you, well, number one, do you ever say, and I know you're not into the politics and all of that, but do you ever commit to a path for citizenship that would be, you know, short of amnesty? Let's say we're not going to have amnesty, I doubt. Anyway, and so do you ever come up with a plan for that? And secondly, do you think that if we legalized drugs here in the United States, if that would make a huge difference to what happens between Mexico and the United States?
Heavy questions, actually. Do I have an idea of how to, the first part is how to potentially create a path towards a lot of people who are illegal becoming meaningful legal citizens of our society. And the second one is, can potentially changing something about the demand that we have in our country for drugs, can that potentially have an effect south of the border as to what is going on out there, not only in the trafficking, but also the human rights, how they are being violated, the people who are dying, innocent people on the streets, I believe, who are in the middle of the crossfire and these things. So for the first one, I honestly do not have a solution for whether or not there's anything we can do. I am beginning to think about it as I am beginning to be engaged by national people and to think about it. I can only illustrate what has happened to me in my life. But once again, people will argue, well, the chances of you becoming who you are today or anybody else are small. As a matter of fact, the year that you came, we made 12 million people legal, and we really don't know where the other 12 million are. That's an argument I saw yesterday in the LA Times, by the way. You know, and that, and to be honest with you, I don't have an answer for that. All I can say is that not everybody needs to become a brain surgeon. We need teachers. We need carpenters. We need plumbers. We need good people who are going to be working and doing work. But what we do need to do is change the way we think about work. Most people think about work 9 to 5, 5 days a week. I am passionate about what I do, and some of you guys may remember what it was like when you guys were little and how hard your families work. You know, other places in the world are working 6 or 7 days a week, 12 hours a day. And if we don't get smart, we are going to be outsourcing for them. It's inevitable. And that's going to be maybe within our lifetime or the lifetime of our children, our grandchildren. You know, and the second one is about the drugs and you know, south of the border. Oh, my gosh. I mean, this is a tough question. Obviously, we have, I don't think they're disconnected, by the way. One of the reasons why we have children dealing drugs, doing drugs, is because they see that as a quick way to make money. Because we sensationalize in our society, you know, our movie stars, our singers. And I am disappointed many times. 2 weeks ago, I got an email from the White House where they are doing a forum on education, in Hispanic education. It's not like we have a lot of people, but we have people like Sotomayor. We have people like Hernandez, who's an astronaut. And guess who they are featuring? Shakira. Nothing wrong with Shakira. She's a very accomplished singer. But in my mind, that's not the kind of person that I would illustrate as a person who should lead an effort in education. It's okay if she wants to donate money out of her millions. That's okay, but that's a different thing. And that's what is so sad about our society. And I am guilty of that, to be honest with you. Alrighty? So we need to change our priorities. But certainly changing our education, telling our kids it's okay to invest 10, 12, 20 years of your life in education. At the end, you're going to have a brighter future. We got to start with that at least. So I think if we do that, that will have an impact as to what the demand is for illicit drugs in the United States.
This is maybe a simpler question. I'm just curious, when you were a farm worker, were you able to join with Cesar Chavez's union, UFW, or have you received any benefits from that association?
Well, I was never able, you know, when I first came, by that time Cesar Chavez had died a few years prior. I knew of Cesar Chavez, obviously. The way that I benefited from his work was very simple. When you look at my uncles and the people who had come as braceros to work, they used to use a small, you know, sort of tools to go down and be on their knees or their backs. And that was, now as a brain and spine surgeon, which is what I do, I can only imagine the stress that puts on your body, on your back, your herniated disc. A lot of people has had a lot of back problems. And I'm sure that some of you guys who could probably work in the fields around that time with your own families, you remember those days. So he was able to change. So I benefited indirectly by not having to do that kind of labor, obviously. No, the only time I met Dolores Huerta last year, I met some of the family from Cesar Chavez, and they have invited me to give talks. And I did get a quote once about being afraid from Cesar Chavez, who said once that if you're not afraid, you know, you're never going to get the job done. If you are afraid, you'll work like crazy. And I've been afraid of failure my whole life. Every day I walk into the operating room with my patients, I'm afraid that they're not going to wake up after surgery, alrighty, and I work like crazy to make sure that that doesn't happen. You know, same thing with my laboratory. So I'm always afraid of failure, but I'm even more afraid of not trying. Please.
Question. In our family, we are dealing with a situation with major squamous cell carcinoma. So personal level, I also have a son who trained at UCSF and Stanford who's a radiation oncologist
yes.
in this area.
Congratulations.
So my question is, both from a personal standpoint and from perhaps the point of view of a physician who's in a field that might be involved with referrals, how do people get to you?
Thank you for the question. I am very blessed, of course. In Hopkins, I have a huge team. I grew faster than anybody else. There's 23 brain surgeons in my department. They're all superstars, as you can imagine. They're the elite of brain surgery. And somehow I've been able to grow faster than anybody, and I have a huge team. So I do see referrals all the time, and I'm very, like right now, when I turn my phone on as I am heading out to UCSF, I'm going to answer about 20 emails of referrals. And I delegate, and when I go back, I have a whole day where I review cases from all over the world, and that's what I do. And I do this in between. So there's a web page at Hopkins Neurosurgery.org, and then my name pops out right there. And there's an email that is checked by two of my fellows and two physician assistants dedicated to me. Thank you.
Do you have any interaction with neurosurgeons in Mexico?
Yes. As a matter of fact, this summer, you know, people have asked me, you know, and I cannot take credit for this. Mike Lawton, who is a professor here at UCSF in neurosurgery, very famous vascular surgeon, 2 years ago, said to me, Alfredo, you know, I have reached the pinnacle of neurosurgery. That is, I've written books and I get invited from all over the world to do mission work, to operate on people who have no access to resources. But he said, you're my best friend. You are dedicated to cancer. My sister died of cancer. That was one of the reasons. If you look at my book, I talk about his sister. And he says, I would like to go to Mexico with you. And I said, Mike, this is 4 years into. I am not at that stage in my life. I have a lot of stuff going on in my lab. My lab is growing rapidly. My practice, I'm doing 300 cases a year. You know, and then I went home, and he said to me towards the end, he goes, I want you to think about it. And I went home, and I knew also that we didn't have any funding. So whatever we did, we were going to pay out of our pocket. So I went home, and if you go to my house, despite of my fame and glory, there are still rooms in my house that still have no furniture. I'm an academic neurosurgeon. Most people don't realize that. All right, I live well, but I don't make the kind of money that people in private practice make. But I'm very happy. I wouldn't change it any other way. So I go home and I ask my wife, and it says, well, maybe you bring Gabby with you. Gabby is my oldest daughter, and she's in the book. She's 12 now. And you've been trying to tell her what you do, and you want her to understand what it's like not to have. All right, because my kids, despite of the fact that when we were residents here, my wife and I, we didn't even have money one day to buy a cheeseburger here in the most expensive city in the United States in 1999 when we landed, they grew up with food on the table, which is not a luxury that I had. So I took her to Mexico, and we did a bunch of cases, you know, in Mexico and Guadalajara. We took care of all the indigent population from Chiapas and Oaxaca, very challenging cases. But we not just did the surgery. We share our techniques and our experience with the local neurosurgeons there, obviously. And this goes back to the idea of teaching someone how to fish, and they'll feed themselves for many more years than if you just give them the fish. You know, so that's my interaction with Mexico. And now we are, and a lot of more people are interested in funding our resources, sending equipment. And I was at the Congress of Neurological Surgeons just 2 weeks ago, and a lot of companies are interested in funding a lot of these trips. It's another little way that where we can do something around the world to show people that the United States is still a very giving country.
Doctor, please. Only if you have time, because I know you're ready to run, but I have three very short questions. Number one, what motivates you? Number two, what do your siblings do? And number three, do you still get death threats?
Number one, what motivates me is my patients, and I talked about them, you know, struggling with cancer. Number two, my siblings, my brother, Gabriel, who is about 2 years younger than me. He's about 41 right now. He is in San Diego. He's a very successful business person. He's in mobile technology. He started his own business, went to school, got a master's in business administration from UC San Diego. My next sister is Rosa, who came. She got married when she was 15. She's got two daughters. She and her husband, Raymond, was the one who saved my life. He also was the one who taught me how to weld. He also has his own successful business, welding and doing a lot of heavy-duty welding throughout the California Valley. And then my other two siblings, they are, one is in Vegas working for Bank of America, and my other younger brother, he's an artist. You know, he's got the best life I can possibly imagine. So, and then I still do receive death threats. And you know what? I mean, I can't change who I am. And now I'm sure with the book coming out and more publicity, it's going to be even worse. And I do. The only thing that I fear is the safety of my family and those around me. So I am very careful nowadays. I was in UC Davis just 2 days ago. I spoke to a crowd of 4,500 students. I was in Stockton just on Saturday. There was a crowd of 3,000 people. And it was amazing. Luckily, they had security. But, you know, I'm just a regular guy. I'm not a celebrity by any means. Although people, they want to touch me sometimes. It's kind of weird. And I don't know how to explain it, but I do receive people who feel very strongly. You know, there's a lot of, people have a lot of hate in their hearts sometimes. So.
Our thanks to Dr. Quinones for his comments here today. And now this program, the Commonwealth Club, celebrating more than 100 years of enlightened discussion, is adjourned.
Thank you.